Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Peter Allison. He is the network director for the New England's Farm to Institution organization, and he will tell us more of what that means in just a little bit. But I thought it was really appropriate to have him on because October is Farm to School Month, which is a part of a Farm to Institution program. Farm to School Month is trying to connect more schools with buying food from local farms. And Peter will come on a little bit and talk to us more about that. But first, I want to tell you some things going on in and around the city that you might want to participate, some things that I'd really like you to participate in, and also some things that are in the news that I want to make us all aware of. So tonight, October 26th, there is the Healthy School Food Gala, which is an annual event run by the Coalition for Healthy School Food. And this will be my fifth or sixth year, I think, providing food for this gala. It's a wonderful, wonderful evening, and if you are not doing anything tonight, I really recommend you going online and getting a ticket for it. They also have a online auction as a way of donating. But what the Coalition for Healthy School Food does is they help bring more plant-based foods into public schools. And it used to be the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food because they really were working just in the New York State. But they have since expanded, so they've dropped the New York, and it's just the Coalition for Healthy School Food now. And this event will take place at the New York Academy of Medicine tonight, beginning at, I believe it's 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. And there's over 100 of samplings of food and drink and dessert, all 100% plant-based. There's quite a bit of gluten-free there as well, and really delicious, savory food, and there's live music, and it's just really raising awareness and supporting these programs that are trying to bring better food to our kids in schools. So it's a great organization, and I hope to see some of you there. Also this weekend, there's many different marches going on as a anniversary for the Sandy 5 superstorm that we had, Sandy 5 March for Awareness. There's one taking place marching from Brooklyn, from Cadman Plaza into New York City and then rallying in front of the Alfred E. Smith houses in Manhattan. And then there's also one on the 29th on Long Island at the Venetian Shores in Lindenhurst. And there's many others I've heard of. I've heard of one in Oceanside. I'm sure the Rockaways are doing something. New Jersey's probably doing something. But 5 years ago, Hurricane Sandy really devastated the whole New York area, anywhere along the shoreline especially. And since then, there's been many opportunities where our legislators, our New York City mayor and the governor of New York State really could have been making better choices in preparation for the changes coming from climate change. And as a group, we and many other of the nonprofit grassroots organizations that have signed on are not feeling satisfied with the decisions that our government is making in regards to protecting us from the effects of climate change. And so this march, just like the climate march that we had many years ago, will be a big showing of support for these new laws that we need to create to protect ourselves. Right now, you know, we just feel like the decisions being made are really more geared for big business and protecting Wall Street than it really is protecting the people who are most impacted by these horrible storms. So please come out and show your support. Google Sandy 5 and you'll find a march near you. And I will be at the one in New York City on Saturday, October 28th, meeting at 11 a.m. at Cadman Plaza in Brooklyn. So I will see you there. And then the October 29th one in Lindenhurst starts at 2 o'clock at the Venetian Shores Park. Also, October 31st, of course, there's the Halloween parade that happens every year down in the village. That's always a fun thing. But there is also a debate going on on animal welfare policy at NYU, Wagner Food Policy Alliance. And this should be a really interesting discussion, talking about the debates of animal welfare and food and whether eating meat is a sustainable thing, something that we should be doing, not doing. It's just going to be a discussion, and the admission is free, and it should be interesting. You can register online if you're interested in going. Again, that's on October 31st, and it's debating the animal welfare policy that we have going on in this country. Also, on November 1st, there is an event at the Woolley Botanical Gardens in Tribeca. And this is a discussion called Brain Food, Part of the Chef and the Doctor Series. And that should be a great event. November 2nd, there is a tour and tasting at Goodwater Farms. That's out in Bridgehampton, and that will be, it's being sponsored by Slow Food East End. Oh, talking about slow food, let me just tell you that this past weekend we had an awesome, awesome event, Slow Food North Shore, which is the chapter that I run. We had our last hurrah. It was the last party with the current board, meaning myself and my fellow board members. We're all stepping down, and we hope to be welcoming a new board. We saw a lot of interest at the event. People have been emailing me saying that they don't want to let Slow Food North Shore die down, and so they're willing to step up to the plate. So I couldn't be more thrilled. I love the slow food movement. I think it is one that really brings the concepts and the ideals of good, clean, and fair food together with the pleasures of the table and bringing people together around eating the really good food. And I have just seen the power of food and the love that comes from people sharing really good food together, and it just really motivates me to keep going. So anyway, check out events sponsored by Slow Food. They're always great events. November 3rd and 4th, there is a conference going on called New York City Loves Food Loves Tech Industry Conference. And it is, I've been to one before. This one's taking place at Industry City in Brooklyn. And it brings a lot of food technology people who are doing innovative things with technology having to do with food. So that would include hydroponics, aquaponics. It would include certain systems that they're setting up to help address food waste. It also would include all the different apps that are popping up, from meal delivery services to meal sharing programs to shopping, ordering recipes and the food for the recipes online. There's so many ways that technology can help us with food. But as we know, all technology is not always good. So come with an open mind and check out what different people are sharing with you and make your own decision. There is a craft fair going on at Restoration Farm on November 5th. That's always a great opportunity to buy some early holiday gifts. The Hunter College has a great food policy organization, part of the CUNY Graduate School, and they will be having another event on November 9th from 9 to 10:30. This one is Lessons for the Next Decade, what we've been doing right and what we've been doing wrong since 2007. So come out if you're interested in food policy. Find out what has changed in the last decade, what we can do better, and what we can do to strengthen our food system going forward. Slow Food New York City is having a fundraiser on November 8th at the Project Farmhouse. For those of you that are not familiar with Project Farmhouse, this past weekend they had a great event there called Keep Organic in the Soil. But Project Farmhouse is a new event space in the city that is making itself available to any of the grassroots organizations having to do with food. I've gone to book launches there, food tastings. This is going to be Slow Food, New York City's fundraiser, but it's a great new space that opened last year, and it's just been having some wonderful events there. So if you are free on Wednesday, November 8th, come on out to Slow Food, New York City's fundraiser and show your support there. November 9th is the annual River Fund Gala. The River Fund New York is the food pantry that I partner with every year when I feed the homeless. This will be my 23rd year creating a Thanksgiving feast for the homeless. On my website, I have a sign-up, a doodle document, where you can sign up for a cooking shift. All the shifts are 3 hours. People rotate through the IE Green Homestead, coming in and helping to wash vegetables, make mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, cook the turkeys, everything that one would expect for a traditional Thanksgiving meal. Plus, of course, we have tofu with vegetarian mushroom gravy, and all the stuffing is vegetarian. Basically, everything's vegetarian except the turkey. And we have a tofu alternative for that because, believe it or not, there are quite a few vegetarians waiting on those long lines for a meal. And so I'm really happy to serve them as well, of course. So if you would like to sign up and share in this big fundraiser that I do every year, I'd love to have your support for that. And we serve on, well, the cooking takes place Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, beginning November 18th, 19th, 20th, 21, and then we are serving them on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. The event is always the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. But in the meantime, if you want to come out to the River Fund's annual gala, that's Thursday, November 9th, from 7 to midnight. Tickets are a bit pricey, but certainly going to a good cause. So hope you can make it to that. Lots of other great events coming up, but like I said, I don't want to take the time right now to go over them with you. But I do want to have time to share my recipe with you. So I made a great recipe this week. I had leftover mushroom stems. I did a lot of grilled portobello mushrooms for the Slow Food event this past weekend. And I had all the mushroom stems left over, so I was like, what can I do with that? So I made a corn-encrusted tofu with a mushroom remoulade sauce topped with seared mushrooms and peppers. And it just came out great. So this recipe is vegan and gluten-free, so it's able to be enjoyed by everybody out there. So there's many different parts to it. First, for the egg substitute for breading the tofu cutlets, I use 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed with 4 tablespoons of water and just a pinch of salt. And I mix that up in a shallow pie pan so that I can dip the tofu pieces in that. And then for the corn crust, I used 1 cup of organic gluten-free corn flakes that I didn't grind them in the food processor because I really wanted them to be very coarse, but I did crumble them just in my hands before putting them into the pie plate. And I also added 1/2 cup of corn masa flour, which is cornmeal with some lime in it. It's really delicious. And 1/4 cup of tortilla, gluten-free tortilla crumbs. And I put that in along with 2 tablespoons of cilantro and 1/4 teaspoon of salt. And that was the crumb topping. The crumb crust for the tofu cutlets. And then for the sauce, I used 1 cup of burdock root. And I was, you know, burdock root is something that is not added to that many recipes, but it's like an umami. It gives an extra depth of flavor to gravies and sauces. And so I love when I have an opportunity to use it. It takes a little longer to cook because it's such a hard root vegetable. But I just dug it up outside in my garden. I had some wild burdock growing, and I also planted some burdock. So I just dug that up, and the burdock root looks a lot like carrots, except it's very dark brown. And when you peel it underneath, it's like white, like a parsnip. But anyway, so I used 1 cup of burdock root, 1 onion that I chopped, 1 celery that I chopped, 1 carrot that I chopped. And you don't have to chop it too fine because it's really going to cook down, and then you're going to be pureeing the whole thing anyway. 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, 1 tablespoon of minced ginger, 3 cups of those mushroom stems. And if you don't have mushroom stems, you can use the whole mushrooms, of course. It's just a good opportunity to use up mushroom stems if you have them lying around. 2 teaspoons of ground fenugreek, 3/4 teaspoons of cardamom, 1/2 teaspoon of thyme, 1/2 teaspoon of cumin, 1/8 teaspoon of cayenne, 3/4 teaspoon of salt, 2 cups of water, 2 tablespoons tamari, 1 tablespoon coconut oil, 1/4 teaspoon white pepper, and 2 tablespoons red wine. And that's for the sauce. And then I garnished it with some seared mushrooms and peppers. So I just took 1 8-ounce box of baby portobellos, 1 long sweet red pepper that I cut into very thin slivers, 1 teaspoon of minced garlic, 1 splash of red wine, and 1 splash of tamari. So I started by cutting the tofu and laid that out on a dish towel just to absorb some of the excess water. And meanwhile, in a large, in a saucepan, I heated up a little bit of olive oil, and I added the burdock root, the onion, the carrots, and the celery, and let that cook down for about 10 minutes, stirring occasionally so that it's not going to stick to the bottom, but just, you know, cook that down. Mostly it's the burdock root that really takes the longest amount of time to cook, but you're going to add all those root vegetables together. Then you're going to add the garlic and just cook that down. Then after 10 minutes, you can add the mushrooms, the ginger, and all of the spices and let that cook for about another 5 minutes. And then you're going to add 2 cups of boiling water to that and let that simmer for about 10 minutes, stirring occasionally. And it can simmer even longer. You're just letting it cook down and let all the vegetables get really, really soft because you're going to be pureeing it. And the softer they are, the easier they'll puree. And so after 10 minutes or 20 minutes, take that off the heat, and you're going to puree that using an immersion blender. If you don't have an immersion blender, you can certainly pour it into a Vitamix, and that would work too. And then I felt like it needed a little bit of, finishing some fat in it. So I added the coconut oil at that point. Just a little bit. It's 1 tablespoon of coconut oil just to give a little fat to the gravy. And I also added at that point the tamari and some of the red wine and blended that up with the immersion blender until the sauce is really smooth. And it's relatively a thick sauce. You can thin it out a little bit with some more hot water if it's too thick for you. But I really didn't want it to be a runny sauce. I wanted it to be more of a sauce that was kind of like the thickness of mayonnaise, I'd say. And then I made the mixture with the flaxseed and the water in a shallow pie pan. And in the other pie pan, I put the corn flakes with the masa flour and the tortilla crumbs and the cilantro and the salt. And I made the breading there. So I dipped the tofu cutlets one at a time in the flaxseed and water mixture, which was my egg substitute, and then into the corn flour, and laid it out on a cookie sheet that I lined with parchment paper, and I spread a little bit of olive oil on top of the parchment paper. You can spray it or just spread it around. And put each tofu cutlet down, continue until all the tofu cutlets are breaded. Put them in the oven at about 400 degrees. Let it cook for 10 minutes on one side. Then turn the tofu cutlets over so that the other side also gets golden brown. And while those are cooking in the oven, you can saute the mushrooms and the peppers in a little olive oil. I used my cast iron frying pan for that. Just add a little splash of the red wine and the tamari right before cooking it. Then I took the tofu cutlets out of the oven. I used very little oil, so there's no reason, you're not deep frying them, so you don't have to drain the oil off. But they come out very crunchy like that. And so I placed them right onto a platter. I put the pureed sauce down the middle, and I topped it with the seared mushrooms and peppers. Not only looked beautiful, but it really tasted really great. So I love hearing from those of you that go forward and try out my recipes. As many of you know, one of the reasons I'm stepping down from chairing my slow food chapter is so I can create more time in my busy schedule to finish a cookbook that I started years ago. People have been asking me for a long time to put some of these recipes in a book, and I am trying to do that. So I'll keep you posted on that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Peter Allison is the Network Director for Farm to Institution New England, also known as FINE. And he started there back in 2011. He was hired by the founding partners to coordinate the farm-to-institution network in the New England area. And he'll tell us more about what that does. But he has over 30 years of sustainability program leadership in a wide array of nonprofits, government, and business roles. And he's been focusing on food system change since 2007. And I'm really thrilled to have him joining us. Peter, you with me?
I am. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really happy to have you on, especially as we celebrate Farm to School Month for October. But before we get into that, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about your organization. What is the Farm to Institution New England organization, and what does that mean?
Sure, happy to. So Farm to Institution New England, or FINE, as you mentioned, we've been around since 2011, and our focus is really mobilizing the power of institutions in the New England region to help transform our food system. What that means on a day-to-day basis is that we work with really scores and hundreds of organizations around the region who are focusing on getting more local food produced and processed in the region, used by the K-12 schools, the colleges and universities, healthcare facilities, and other institutions on a regular basis in their cafeterias. And the reason we're interested in getting that local food used by institutions is that we feel it really helps support a diversified market for the producers in the region, brings better, healthier local fresh food to the eaters at the institutions, and helps support good supply chain jobs and businesses, you know, from production all the way through all the way to the table. So it helps support our local agricultural economy, as well as getting good food to the consumers and helping the farmers at the front end.
Mm-hmm. And do most of the places make arrangements ahead of time, like pre-arrange buying the vegetables or the produce from the farmers that they plant specifically for that institution?
Well, it happens in a variety of different ways. There are some cases where a school or a college or a hospital will make an arrangement directly with a farmer. Sometimes it's quite formal, you know, contract growing where they, in the best sense of the word, where they make a commitment to buy product the next growing season so the farmer can put a special amount of crop in the ground or dedicate some acres or fields to the institutional buyer. In other cases, the institutions work through produce vendors or fish distributors or meat distributors to source that product for them, and those distributors may get product from a variety of different producers in order to meet the demand of a particular institution, particularly the bigger institutions. So we see that there's a real variety from that direct procurement all the way to part of an approved vendor arrangement through their distributor or in some cases through their food service management company that works with distributors, that works with producers. So there's a range of ways in which the product actually gets from the field or the sea to the institution itself.
Uh-huh. And as an organization, do you help kind of like bundle organizations together so that they're buying in a greater bulk from the farmer? And do you act as kind of a middleman, or is it more direct? Each institution is going directly to the different farmers.
Well, we're a network, and we really exist to support a lot of other organizations in the region that are involved in getting food from the production, the local production on the farm or in seafood, to the institutions. And so we have organizations some are local, some are regional, that are just dealing with, K-12 schools. So some that really focus on the healthcare sector, some that are working with the college and university sector. And we're a cross-sector, multi-state network that supports all those organizations with best practices and communications, events, metrics. And we also do some direct work to help develop new models and test strategies. But the groups within the network are involved in a variety of ways. Some of them are making direct relationships between the producer and a school, for example, and they'll hold Meet the Buyer events and bring the producers out to an event and bring in the buyers at a forum that makes it really easy for them to talk to each other, develop those relationships, think about what kind of products they can buy from each other, and make those deals. In other cases, as I say, there are aggregators, there's food hubs who are involved, or small distributors, all the way up to the bigger distributors. Increasingly, we're seeing that a lot of the institutions want to buy through a distributor because it means fewer trucks arriving at their docks on a daily basis, and it makes it more efficient. One of the key things that we're working to do is make sure that that relationship is maintained between the farmer or the fisher person and the institution so that they can tell the story of the local food they're using in their cafeterias. And as you can imagine, as you add more people in the middle of the supply chain, it becomes harder to maintain that story and to maintain that understanding of where that product is coming from. But there's some really good ways that folks are starting to do that. I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, there are clearly institutions of all sizes and all types who are buying from producers in their area. And, you know, they'll talk about what kind of product they want, what kind of quantity. Sometimes they'll even mentally process it for the institution, diced carrots or peeled butternut squash, for example, freeze broccoli. And in other cases, it's done as part of a more formal arrangement through the vendors that they use, the distributors that they use.
Mm-hmm. You know, so have you gotten any distributors that are like local distributors that specialize in just working with local farmers so that you don't lose the story, or not really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually pretty impressed by the commitment of the distributors in our region here in New England who are, you know, they have long-standing relationships with the producers, and they go to the farm gate, and they pay on time, and they pick up the product, and they are helping to sort of tell that story. In some cases, the producers make that arrangement directly with the institutions, but they still use a distributor to actually get the product from point, you know, from their gate to the institution itself. And as you can imagine, there's institutions of all sizes. I mean, there's schools, I'm up here in Vermont, that have literally 50 or 60 kids in the whole school, all the way to UMass Amherst, which serves 45,000 meals a day.
Wow.
So it's a huge range. You know, overall, the institutional market is really significant. A quarter of the people in New England, 3.8 million people, eat at institutions during the course of the year. And even more, work at institutions. Institutions are one of the biggest employers in the New England region. So in addition to the actual food they're buying and serving, which is significant, they also have a really big impact in terms of the ability to influence the folks who they serve. The students who are learning and doing studying, the people who are being tended to at the healthcare facilities, visitors and staff at all these institutions. So it's a big group of people and close to $1 billion in food that institutions in New England buy each year. And we're working to increase that local percentage Right now, it's about 16% on average. And
really? That seems really high, actually. 16% right now in the New England area of institutions provide local food?
Well, the way we say it is that 16% of the food that institutions in New England are buying is local. And local, we define, in some cases, it's nearby. In some cases, it's within the state. In some cases, it's, up to 250 miles, sort of the New England region. And we think that makes sense because here in New England, the northern three states of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine are much more rural. And most of the population is in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. In fact, half of the people in New England live in Massachusetts, but half of the acres of berry and vegetable production are in Maine, and half of all the beef and dairy cattle are in Vermont. So we have sort of a food shed between the whole region, and we try and think about a regional food shed so that we're benefiting from what's available and still close enough to know that it's something that's grown within our region and we're supporting our regional economy and that we have that identity here.
Uh-huh. And, local is one thing, and then we also talk about sustainable and organic. How much of your local food is being raised in a sustainable way, with whether it's certified organic or not? How much of it is being raised with a consciousness to be taking care of the earth in a more regenerative way?
Right. I mean, a really great question and a little bit harder to answer. Clearly, there's some certified organic products that are being purchased by institutions. As you know, with many of those products, they are significantly more expensive. And I also know that there's a lot of local farmers who aren't certified organic, but who are essentially using many of the same practices. I live actually at a co-housing and farming community up here in Heartland, Vermont. It produces lots of vegetables and dairy and beef products. Have a mushroom shiitake CSA, honey and maple syrup. And none of those products are necessarily certified organic, but we know that the standards they're meeting would certainly meet the organic certification. And that, whether it actually would meet all of the elements of the organic certification for a lot of the producers in New England or not, we do know that, the smaller producers tend to, they're not using lots and lots of chemical inputs, in fact, very few, and tend to use much more generative practices, as you say, taking care of the soil, building up the compost, really managing waste and minimizing, use of antibiotics and pesticides or fertilizer is more the pattern that we see up here in the region. There's a lot more small and medium-sized farms here. We don't really have the big ag that we see in many other parts of the country. And so a lot of the relationships are much more, people have a better personal relationship with the growers that they're buying from.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess so much of the issues that I'm hearing about are, even if they're not spraying, if they're buying GMO seeds and then those seeds, get carried by the wind to the next farmer's land or, even with the pesticides, if they are spraying, that they end up going to the other one's property and or, the type of feed that they give to animals, if they're giving animals grain that's all GMO feed, all that, waste then becomes a pollutant as well.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of, one of the products, for New England, it's pretty well suited for grazing. So a lot of the animals that are raised on grass. And, we're finding many more of the grain producers are offering GMO-free grain, as the market is definitely calling for that. And we're seeing New England, you know, Vermont has passed GMO legislation, labeling legislation, and many of the other states have been pushing for that as well. So the, the awareness around GMOs, the demand for GMO-free product, and for information about whether it's contained in their product is increasing, as is the demand for local in general. I mean, our we've completed a series of surveys over the past couple years, and what we're finding is that you know, a vast majority of institutions are looking for more and more local products, and the distributors who we've talked to are working to respond to that, and the producers that are serving the institutional market recognize that the institutional market is representing a growing opportunity for them. So we're seeing, even though we're seeing some flattening in the direct markets for consumer direct markets around for local production, that the institutional markets are seeing some increasing opportunity.
And how much have you grown? Have you seen it grow a lot since 2011 when you first started to 2017?
Yeah, our part of the issue is getting reasonable data to measure that, but it's clear. So our the data that we have now is sort of our first baseline in some cases. But anecdotally, we know that the institutions, and one of the cases we know this is that the companies that are hired in many cases to provide the dining operations for the institutions, these food service management companies, they're reporting that almost every institution that's looking for new services is specifying that they want, you know, local food, sustainably raised food, in the requests for proposals and in those contracts. So they're getting that pressure from their customers who are the institutions. And as a result, they're developing the supply chain relationships, you know, through their distributors and the producers in order to meet that demand. So it's, you know, from all parts of the system, we're hearing that the demand is going up. And people are finding more and more creative ways to meet that demand while also, you know, working within the pretty constrained pricing structure that institutions have. You know, public schools have very fixed amounts of food funds that they can spend on food. It's about a dollar, you know, or $1.30 per meal. So it's not a lot of room in the food budget. But we're finding a lot of creativity in the schools to do that through some clever menuing and supply relationships, and some of the states are stepping forward with grants and other assistance to help make that possible. And even in the college and university, it has a little bit more room, a little bit more funds to spend on food, you know, per meal. They still have cost constraints. I have a son who's in college, and I know that we, you know, as a parent, you don't want to see your the tuition costs go up a whole lot. On the other hand, the student demand, parents, alumni, faculty are all pushing to get much better food because the local food and the good food movement is everywhere, and it's clearly showing up on institutions. So, for example, the work you're doing in your show to help elevate these issues and talk about events and talk about recipes and people who are doing innovative stuff, that's part of the whole culture, and that clearly is part of the whole culture even within institutions. So it's all growing together.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, you know, another issue that has been coming up all the time is the issues around food waste. Now, as a network working with farm to institutions, are you doing anything to, does your organization get all at all involved in helping people deal with their food waste a little bit better, whether to compost it? Is there, are there any regional pickups for composting or places to, composting when it's no longer can be used, but when it's left over, maybe even sharing it, you know, from one institution to the next.
Right. Well, the first thing we really focus on is helping institutions think about how they can reduce food waste in the first place, because sometimes that's one of the most critical ways to save enough funds to spend a little more money on quality products. If you reduce your food waste by 20%, you have 20% more funds to spend on the product. So institutions are very aware of that, and there's some excellent organizations that are working to help the dining operations really look at everything from inventory control and purchasing all the way through how they prepare food and serve it. And then obviously encouraging, students to not take more food than they're going to eat. This is particularly the case with college campuses, which often offer an all-you-care-to-eat dining situation. So students will go in and their eyes are much bigger than their stomachs, and they'll take, four or five things, and then they realize they're not that hungry and it goes to waste. So, there's a lot of things that can be done in the back end of the house, inventory control to make sure food's not spoiling before it's served, how they prepare it so they can maximize the amount of food that's actually getting to the plate, and then clearly really sending the message that, just because you're not paying per meal doesn't mean you should, you really need to be cognizant of reducing waste. So there's some pretty clever strategies like trayless dining, so that you don't have a big tray where you can stick all this stuff on it. The students just go through and fill their plate. They're much less inclined to take way more than they can eat.
Sure.
But you're right. At the end of the day, there's going to be some leftover food waste in the kitchen and in the cafeteria. And there are programs both to help recover that food and provide it to those who can eat it. And then also there are institutions that are composting food waste, in some cases on campus, in other cases through pickup programs. Several of the states in New England are enacting or about to enact bans on food waste so that the infrastructure for composting and anaerobic digestion will be continuing to increase. And the systems to recover that food will be increasing alongside it.
Great.
And in the same time, the incentive to reduce the amount of food waste in the first place from an environmental perspective, from a and a cost perspective are really the first and foremost.
Right, right. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I would like to talk a little bit about the food processing, whether you're getting involved or you're helping farmers find places to have the food processed. Because from what I've heard, one of the deterrents for so many institutions from getting food from local producers is processing it. They don't have the staffing, let's say, to wash the, 400 pounds of potatoes that they're going to get in a delivery. And I've heard that there's not enough places actually processing the potatoes ahead of time for them. So, when we come back, maybe we can talk about that. Everyone listening, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here talking with Peter Allison from the New England's Farm to Institution Network. Be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Peter Allison from the New England's Farm to Institution Network. And we're just talking about helping institutions procure more local food. And right before the break, we're going to address how they process the food. So, Peter, you with me again?
Hi, still here, yes.
Great. So, So anyway, yeah, I was talking to New York City Public Schools about, you know, getting more local local foods, and they were saying, you know, their biggest challenge is, you know, processing it. I mean, they don't have the staffing if they were to get a truckload of potatoes, for instance. Are there more processing plants happening now that more people are looking for local food to turn those potatoes into, you know, I don't know, either hash browns or French fries, or of course we don't want to be feeding them French fries, but even frozen roasted potatoes. You know, are there more places popping up that are processing the foods to make it easier for some of the institutions?
This is a question that we get a lot, and there's clearly a strong demand for minimally processed, you know, fruits and vegetables and other products in the institutional cafeterias for just the reason you mentioned. It requires equipment, it requires storage, it requires skills and staff time to take that whole product and prepare it so that it can be served in, you know, often really short time span, particularly with the K through 12 lunch period. We've for several years have been working with a group of processors here in New England. We call it the Processing Community of Practice. And there's six or seven of these operations that are up and built around the New England region. And each of them have certain expertise, sets of equipment and skills and products that they focus on. What we did with this community practice is we actually created the opportunity for all of them to travel around and see each other's facilities, look at the equipment, talk to each other about everything from how do they make sure they're meeting the food safety requirements to keeping you know, people employed and developing the skills and looking at marketing outlets, everything you can imagine. We created a series of case studies that you can find on our website, which is firmtoinstitution.org, under processors. And we have a short video, case studies, and some issue papers addressing the issues that these facilities are facing. Yes, we are working to help the existing processing facilities be better able to meet the institutional market and help them think about products that they can offer and sales relationships to create that. Commonwealth Kitchen in Dorchester, Massachusetts has started to put a lot of effort into this, and they're supplying schools and colleges in the Boston area with some new products ranging from, you know, tomato sauce to cut carrots and root vegetables and starting to make some other products. In Western Massachusetts, the Western Mass Food Processing Center in Greenfield has an IQF, a freezing operation. So they're able to take broccoli and other vegetables, fruit, and they blanch it, they cube it, they bag it, and then they freeze it at a very low temperature so that it's available year-round. It extends the growing season, which is the other reason mm-hmm. that processed food is really important if you want to source local. And so they've got some really great relationships with the schools and colleges and healthcare facilities in their region. One of the things we're looking at is there a way that these processors can be better linked together to actually help supply the institutions to in a cooperative way so they can think about, well, this institution needs, you know, more product than we're able to prepare at the state, but if we can kind of aggregate and support that. Now, the downside, of course, is that every time you add another player in the middle of the supply chain, you're adding costs. And so being able to meet those demands for the processed food and meet the price point that's met by the national companies that work at such large scale, but where you don't really know where the food's coming from is a really big issue. So helping the processors really think about how they can get their product processed and delivered to the institutions as efficiently and cost-effectively as possible is really important. But at the same time, they obviously have a strong commitment to paying the producers, the farmers who are growing the product, a fair price, because that's part of what the mission is overall. So the good news is there's more, more and more deals that are being made, and the ongoing challenge is meeting the supply at a price that makes sense. And then the question becomes, well, should we, should there be more of these facilities? And you know, the issue is that they're fairly capital intensive. You know, they're expensive to build and to bring in the equipment. So making sure that the market is there and the business plan is in place to justify a new investment makes sense. But it is something that we've brought funders, investors, financiers together for both the public and the private sector to help think about, well, where are there opportunities for these different funding entities to work better together to create sort of a funding stack, a series of funding and finance instruments that will help these nonprofits or these businesses get the capital they need to build build the infrastructure that's needed to get that processed product. So that's a long answer. The short of it is that there is a lot of interest in getting processed food. There's people who are doing it. We're trying to help them be as effective as possible and really explore if there's opportunities to build more of those facilities, what's the best place to do that, and how do we make sure they have a good business plan in place before moving forward. When I say we here, I'm talking about the sort of broad network of organizations and agencies, the public agencies, the private financiers that are involved in this. There's so many different players that are really committed to making this happen. And, you know, as they say, our role as a network is to help facilitate the communications and relationships to make everyone be more effective in doing their piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, just a question. Do any of these institutions, are any of them interested in trying to grow their own food? Or they're, you know, that's just like a whole other area and they're really not interested in that. They just, you know, I just think that so many, especially universities, have so much extra land that they could be growing food, but unless you have someone to really take that project on, that's not going to help you at all.
No, it's a great question. And actually, there's a lot of institutions that do have everything from, you know, educational gardens up to production farms, you know, ranging from, you know, a few acres up to 100 acres, literally.
Really?
Yeah, we're actually holding a conference in February. I'll get you the exact date, at Stonehill College, with Stonehill College in Massachusetts, specifically on the topic of campus farms. So there's a lot of college programs that have that are reaching out. They use it as education, but they're also producing enough product that they can use it within their dining facilities. And some are doing it at a significant level. Amherst and Hampshire and Western Mass, Green Mountain College in Vermont, the College of Atlantic up in on the coast of Maine, all have really significant campus farms. And so this conference is designed to help them think about how they can work together to, you know, learn from each other and how to take advantage of each other's experiences and skills. So we're really excited to be co-hosting that event this year.
That's exciting. Will this be the first one?
This is the first one. We've held a big farmed institution summit the past, we held one last April and then also in April 2015. We're going to do it every 2 years. And we had a track on campus farms there, but this is the first time we're having a standalone event on campus farms. So we're expecting to have over 100 people come to Stonehill College, and we think it'll be a really great success. We have some great speakers lined up and workshops and opportunity for networking.
Oh, that sounds great. What about hospitals? Any interest from hospitals? I would think of the, you know, schools and colleges, because they're also dealing with institutions and because they have pressure from parents to improve the school food, you know, I've seen growth in that area, but I still, it still seems to me that where it's still lacking in institutions is in hospitals. They still have, without fail, the worst food of any institution I've been to. I've been to many hospitals with people who are sick, and the food can make you sick. It's unbelievable. Do you feel like the hospitals are the slowest to come on board with this issue?
Yeah, I wouldn't paint them in such a bleak corner, in part because there are some examples of really excellent operations that are happening right now, and there's some really great programs working with hospitals to improve their food for both for the visitors as well as the patients. You know, the UVM Medical Center up in Burlington, Vermont has been heralded as the national example of great food, and people literally say that it's one of the places people go to eat when they're up in Burlington, which has a lot of fabulous restaurants. So, you know, they've done an incredible job sourcing local and sustainable food, training the chefs to actually prepare a lot of food from whole products. They actually fillet fish there right in the kitchen. They have local beef providers, vegetable producers who bring their product in. Maine Medical Center is another really fabulous eating establishment at a healthcare facility. And one of our key partners is Healthcare Within Harm, and they have a project called Green Health, and have done really quite a bit to help work with sort of working groups in each of the six New England states to think about how they can source local food and prepare it and serve it. You know, with that said, hospitals have a lot of constraints in terms of funds. There's a lot of consolidation in that industry. There's a lot of price pressure with the healthcare insurance issues being so volatile right now. They're always looking to cut costs. So it can have a really negative impact on, you know, at the end of the day, what food they buy and serve. So I'm not trying to sugarcoat. Well, I guess that's a really bad example. I'm not trying to use overly praise them as being the finest dining everywhere. There are some great examples, and there are some real challenges.
That's the difference, I guess, from being in Vermont and New England compared to New York City and Long Island, because I think our hospitals are really behind the ball in that way. But we are just about out of time, Peter. So what I'd like to ask you to do is to share your website one more time with everyone listening. And if you send me information on your conference coming up, I will be sure to put that on my list of events coming up and share it with my network here in New York.
Sure, happy to. And that's the Campus Farmers Summit. It's on February 10th at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts, and I'll send you the information. You can get all of this information on our website, www.farmtoinstitution.org, all spelled out. And we also have a separate website for all the metrics, some of the data that I mentioned, which is called dashboard.farmtoinstitution.org. But I can send you this all in email, and thank you for sharing it. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It really has been. And it's an area that I'm just so passionate about. And I think, you know, getting more local food and sustainable food to those that are, to our children and to people that are ill and to just, you know, to institutions, it's a big thing. It's great for everybody, from the farmers to the people eating it. So thank you for the work you're doing, Peter. And everyone out there listening, thank you again for joining us, and we'll be with you again next week. Have a great rest of the week.